Welcome to our show today. We're going to be continuing our pieces of evidence that look at the contention of NICNT, that's the New International Commentary of the New Testament, which takes an opposing position to what we presented in our first presentation, which was a list of leading scholars and their commentaries and their understanding of fulfill in Matthew 5:17. The question that started us on this path was, can you select a commentary that does not agree with the rest of those scholars? So I did, and it ended up being NICNT. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through what the commentary had to say, which we did, and then the next part, we were going to look at the particular specific verses that they brought out, and we did. And so now, after they have established their position in their analysis concerning Matthew 15 and its parallel section, Mark 7, we're starting to look at the evidence that, is their conclusion correct? Does the history that we know, not just from canonical biblical sources, but also from the rabbinic side, also from the Roman side, and anywhere else outside of Christian writings, does it support the contention of NICNT as regards the Torah and the food laws and ritual purity? Quick reminder, we always start with this. Concerning the Anointed One who's to be sent, the primary purpose as regards the Torah, the law of God, his primary purpose to be sent was to do away with all of God's law, to do away with some of God's law, like the food laws, maybe the feasts, maybe the Sabbath, or fulfill the prophecy in Deuteronomy 18, 15, and 18, in which he'll be a prophet. Prophets call people back to more correct observance of Torah. Will he untangle oral tradition that's like a cancer with the written instructions? Four choices. I'm sure there's more, but those are the four that we've offered. And those are four popular choices. They have a lot of people in each camp. We're going to take number three. The important thing to remember is when you select one, it changes how you read the biblical record. So if you're looking for verses in which the law is done away with in your plain reading of the English text version, you'll find quite a few. And when you pluck them out of the context, you're pretty much guaranteed to fail to find the truth. All right, so I've said it before. I said it again. I'm done with that. Let's move forward. The second segment of this show is going to address Dedeque information. It's going to look at different things that are said, give a little bit of history, give some quotes from some outside sources who have analyzed this, a little bit of history. A lot of that is going to be focused on the Dedeque in the second segment. However, in the first segment, the segment that we're in right now, I need to be able to present where the Dedeque falls within the timeline, because that's important. When you hear what's in the Dedeque, then you're going to realize that we have to address where it is in the timeline. So I'm going to name some key people that we already have talked about. That's why we had to skip, chronologically speaking, in last week's broadcast. We had to move beyond what we're talking about today because I had to set some history that's a few centuries down the road so that I could refer to them in this timeline part of segment one, so that when we get to segment two and you hear what the Dedeque actually talks about, then you will be able to realize the implications of that. The timeline, here we go. Yes, you have heard some of these. No, you will not have heard all of them. I want to start in the first century. Yeshua lived in the first century. Resurrection, ascension, Shavuot, Acts 2, probably took place in the early 30s. According to Eusebius' history, there were 15 bishops who were in charge of the Jerusalem Ecclesia. We understand James, that's Yaakov, in Acts. He's mentioned in 15, also 21. There could be some other verses where he's mentioned as well. He's mentioned in other literature. He was the one that presided over the Jerusalem Council and gave the statement that everybody had discussed, Paul, Peter, other apostles, other elders. He's the one that formulated and presented the opinion, as Luke records it, that the Holy Spirit agreed with, according to what the text says. So that is sometime around 50 AD. Yaakov wrote his own letter. It's called the Letter of James. Martin Luther moved it toward the back of the Bible. That's a whole nother story. Because it doesn't say that faith is all you need. It says faith without works is dead. That was a problem for Luther. So he moved it to the end of the Bible. That letter was probably written around 40 AD. The first letters outside of that would be around 50 AD, Jerusalem Council. That would be Paul's writings. We are going to talk about the first two that most scholars would agree. We call that the scholarly consensus. And what that is Galatians, 1 Thessalonians. Now, Galatians, I don't know which one is first. I'm not even sure it matters which one is first, but I'm going to say Galatians first. In Galatians, Paul is instructing the new believers that we don't do the proselyte ceremony anymore because it involves taking an oath to observe the oral tradition, which is causing you to violate Torah, which rejects Yeshua as Messiah, which therefore cuts you off from the Spirit indwelling to become an image bearer after the image of Yeshua, and replaces Yeshua with the rabbis being your masters. Proselyte ceremony is gone. It is out. It is not trending anymore at the time Paul wrote Galatians. Moving to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, he's talking to the guys there, and he says he is so excited because they are imitating the believers in Judea. Well, let's talk about the believers in Judea. They're mentioned in Acts 21 when Paul returns from a missionary journey, goes back to Jerusalem, meets with Yaakov. Around chapter 21, verse 20, verse 21, in that area, there's a discussion. And Yaakov makes this interesting statement to Paul. Now, your English version will not agree with this. It'll say there are thousands who believe, but the Greek word underneath is tens of thousands, and even that word is plural. So I'm going to say it the way the text was actually written, not the way it's been translated for all of the English Bibles. He turns to Paul and says, look at the tens of thousands believers. And then he adds this other interesting statement, who are all zealous for Torah. So this demonstrates at that point in time, and we're talking 50, so we'll call that the middle of the first century. At that time, things were proceeding quite well. And as we already discussed about Paul remaining a Pharisee, believing the Torah and the prophets, he makes that statement while he is being cross-examined in the trial that is listed in the last part of Acts. He says, I'm a Pharisee. I'm still a Pharisee. I am a Pharisee. Present tense. Not past tense, I was a Pharisee. Present tense, I am a Pharisee. And he believes now, according to the sect of the Nazarenes, which was brought out in 24:5, and which we talked about last week. That's why we had to jump forward, because they recognized several centuries down, this group is still existing. They're still reading all of the scriptures in Hebrew, and of the apostolic writings, they have Matthew in Hebrew. That is mentioned in the history that they have it and they read it. It also mentions some of their doctrinal beliefs. But it demonstrates who this group is. And of course, Paul and Peter and others, they are associated with that. And so if you look at the time of the trial, that's probably in the 60s now. We've moved forward from the Jerusalem Council in the 50s to the 60s. Paul's work was a missionary, and a lot of the assemblies he set up, they had a lot of Gentiles in them. So unlike the Jerusalem assembly, which was mostly Jewish, The Gentile assemblies were mostly Gentile. That was Paul's mission. And yet, in his statement, after all of those assemblies have been established, he's either visited or communicated with them, he states that he still follows what Torah says, what the prophets say, has not done anything opposed to the law of Moses. He's still a Pharisee. He's part of the sect of the Nazarenes. He's a ringleader, which means that the Gentile assemblies are also a part of that. And so that would put them in a position where they continue to observe the Torah. And that makes sense because when we drop back from the 60s, where Paul is on trial, eventually he will go to Rome. He's on his way to Rome, actually, in some of the trial dialogue. Stepping back just a moment to the Jerusalem Council, what you will see is that in 15 verse 20, the statement is made of the four that come out of Leviticus that Yaakov is going to give to those new ones that are coming in, which deals with ritual purity, by the way. Isn't that interesting? But we did cover that. Then, looking in verse 21, the word therefore is the word G-A-R. So there's a conclusion being drawn. Yaakov is stating, these are the four. Here is the reason why we can do that. The Torah is in the synagogue every Sabbath, and the Gentiles will go there on Shabbat, and they will hear, and they will learn. And that shows up in the Dedicate too, which I said is the next segment. And remember, I'm just giving you some pieces that fit the timeline that talk about opposing positions to NICNT's position concerning getting rid of the food laws, which is part of their teaching in the Matthew 5:17 section. So it is not a full examination of Dedicate. That's coming later. We will get into that. But I just wanted to bring out enough pieces so you could see where that writing fit. With that in place, then what happens at the end of the 60s is the destruction of the temple. Then there's the writings of some of the later authors of the apostolic writings. Then there are the additional writings of the apostolic authors. Now, I want to remind you that we're still talking about the bishops and Yaakov, and according to Eusebius, there were 15, and that takes them from approximately AD 30, takes them up. The last Jewish bishop of the Jerusalem Ecclesia, that goes all the way to 135, so that's like 105 years or 100 years. We're going to say approximately 100 years. Once the Bar Kokhba revolt was over, I'll speak about that in a second, that was from 132 to 135, then the bishop of the church in Jerusalem was now a Gentile moving forward, and his name was Marcus. That's just more history. All right, so now let's continue with that timeline piece. We have the beginning. We have Shavuot, we have Peter in Acts 10, we went through that, we have Jerusalem Council, it's 50, we have Paul on trial in the 60s, we have the destruction of the temple in the 70s, Jewish bishops still ruling the Jewish assembly in Jerusalem. Eventually, there's going to come a time in the years 85 when a rabbi or a member of Rabbinic Judaism, Samuel the Little, is asked to add a benediction, and he does, and it deals with the minim, M-I-N-I-M, another complete discussion, but it does have to do with cursing. And interestingly, when we talked about the Netzarim last week, Epiphanes, several centuries later, makes the statement, and I believe Jerome also agrees with that statement, same century, that they're cursed by the Jews. The Netzarim are cursed by the Jews three times a day. I believe both of those writings mention that. So that is the timeline that we're working within. I'm going to name some specifics inside that. But right here, remember, we're doing this timeline to show where the Dedicate fits. Now we have passed the destruction of the temple. We have Samuel the Little writing this curse. We still have Jewish bishops. Toward the end of the century, we have Clement of Rome, and he's talking about how things were laid out in Torah in order for how we are to believe, and he's talking about Levitical priesthood and things of that nature, and the assemblies that were put together, and this includes the ones by Paul, had a level of setup that resembled the synagogue, and you see Clement of Rome talking about that. We will have to review him one day. He's right at the end of the century. So now we're going to cross over into the second century, and I'm going to name some names so that you will be able to place these things in your mind in an order. So we're going to have Ignatius early on. Then not too long after that is going to be the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is going to be like 132 to 135. Then Marcion, he's in there, 130-140. He's the one that created the first Bible. He got rid of everything that was Old Testament, and he kept Luke and a couple of writings of Paul, and then changed those that he didn't like and created his first New Testament. That was interesting. Right after him, Justin Martyr, approximately 150. And I then want to mention, in the Justin Martyr writings, you will see that there's a discussion about those believers who still continue to observe Torah. And his comment is along the line of, well, yes, if they observe Torah, then we can fellowship with them. But there are some people who do not support that position anymore. So by 150, you can see there's already a breakdown. At the same time in 150, Polycarp, who was born in AD 69, so we're talking about he's been doing this a long time, he's there now, he goes to visit Rome because Rome, if you remember, I was talking about after the Bar Kokhba revolt, the last of the 15 bishops now converts to a Gentile. They're not keeping the commandments anymore because it's been outlawed by Hadrian, the emperor. And so now they're starting to create their own traditions. So by 150, they're not observing Passover on the correct date. So Polycarp goes to Rome to talk to the bishop there, Anicetus, and they're having this discussion, and neither one can persuade the other to change. Polycarp says, I've been doing this, I'm following this since I was with the apostles all the way back, you know, early years. And Anicetus' response is, well, I got to do with the traditions that have been established for me by previous bishops from Marcus on. They still got together and they still fellowship, but they didn't change. So now let's jump from 150, which is the middle of the second century, to the end of the second century. And we have this event coming up again. This time, the bishop in Rome is Victor. And what he does is he is tired of this. Some people are observing it on the 14th day of the first month, and other people are observing it on a Sunday. So he says, we need to just stop this, and we need to all come together and do it on Sunday. So the bishop of Ephesus, he pulls the people together, and I say people because I want you to understand the letter that is written, what he says. He mentions key names of people who were all doing it on the 14th day. And after he mentions those, he makes this statement, all these observed the 14th day of the Passover, according to the gospel, deviating in no respect, but following the rule of faith. And I also, the least of you all, do according to the tradition of my relatives, some of whom I have closely followed. For seven of my relatives were bishops, and I am the eighth. And my relatives always observed the day when the people put away the leaven, the 14th day of the first month. I therefore, brethren, who have lived 65 years in the Lord and have met with the brethren throughout the world and have gone through every holy scripture, I'm not afraid of the terrifying words that you're going to excommunicate me. I'm not afraid of that because I'm going to quote Peter from Acts when he says, we ought to obey God rather than man. Well, how many people were at this meeting that Bishop Victor asked him to collect? Well, he writes in the letter, I could mention the bishops who were present, whom I summoned at your desire, whose names, should I write them, would constitute a great multitude. And this large number of bishops of assemblies unanimously agreed that we're going to observe it on the 14th day of the first month, just like the Torah lays out, which is the gospel. So here we are at the end of the second century, and you've got a multitudinous number, a plethora of assemblies that are continuing to observe the Torah, which is the gospel. against Rome. Rome is trying to force their will. These law-observant assemblies are rejecting Rome's attempt. Now, of course, Victor solved this later. He called another meeting, didn't invite any of those people, had a vote, and they went ahead with Sunday. That's another discussion. Here's where that fits in. Second century, we also have the P. Ox 840, which we already reviewed, in which there we have the sect of the Nazarenes. Also, we talked about the sect of the Nazarenes from the standpoint of their commentary of Isaiah, which is the second half of the second century into the first half of the third century. From this collection, you can see that they are right there in the midst, second century, well over 100 years. They're still keeping it. We also mention the martyrs of Lyons in 177 still purchasing food from the Jewish market because they are observing the Torah. And I'll have more of that when I talk about the Didache in the next section. But I think the most important piece of the next section is one of the documents that I make available to you and is discussed, and that's called Torah and Troublesome Apostles in the Didache Community. And what is happening is there are people within the community who they were following Torah because the community was following Torah, and then something happened. They changed positions, and now they're not following it. And in the Didache, it comes right out and says that they are wolves. They have become wolves, and they will destroy the community. So the community is instructed in the Didache, do not allow those people into the community. So I don't know, that seems pretty clear to me. And you know the word that they use that deals with this lawlessness? We know that nomos is the Greek term that's used for Torah. That's also in the Septuagint and the Old Greek. So what we end up with is the same word that Yeshua uses in Matthew when he says, depart from me, you workers of anomia. The Didache states, do not allow into the assembly those who practice anomia. And then it's more clear and it states that we follow Torah. And if you are not teaching that, then you are a false apostle. You're claiming to be an apostle, but you are a false one. And we're not going to let you in. So when we finish this segment, you'll be ready to hear the Didache, which was sometime in the early part of the second century at the latest, and it fits right in with assemblies continuing to observe Torah all the way to the end of the second century. All right, thank you. As we continue to move forward, I want to give you a verse in Revelation before I start into the discussion of the Dedicae. So let me just read it. It's in Revelation chapter 2. And remember, this information that I'm providing at this point is discussing the issue of ritual purity, Matthew 15, Mark 7, and how the NICNT interprets that to mean that the food laws, all things relating to food, have been done away with, ritual purity, that whole thing's been done away with. And we're looking at passages that seem to contradict that position. We've already looked at Peter in Acts 10. We've looked at Paul. We've looked at the Jerusalem Council. So now we're going to continue. And this is in Revelation 2, starting at verse 12. It's the angel of the church in Pergamos write these things. 13, I know thy works, where thy dwellest, even where Satan's seat is, and thou hast holdest fast to my name, and hast not denied the faith. That is good. 14, but I have a few things against you, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols. That's that food piece. 15, so hast thou also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. 16, repent. Repent, written by a Jewish author to a Jewish audience in the first century, Second Temple period, means to change course and come back to a more correct observance of Torah. And of course, in this case, it's Yeshua and his interpretation. So it would seem here that in this address to the ecclesia in Pergamos, we're still talking about food sacrificed to idols, and that's a problem. So if the food laws and the ritual purity laws had been done away with, then eating things sacrificed to idols, that's a food thing. And yet here, the angel doesn't seem to know. Peter didn't seem to know. Paul didn't seem to know. And now here we are in Revelation. They don't know. It just doesn't end. All right, so that concludes the little piece on Revelation. What I want to do is I want to speak a second about the Dedicae. And it's very important that you understand that this is not a study of the Dedicae. That needs its own show. But there are some things in it that relate to the two subjects that we're discussing. First one was Torah observance, Matthew 5, 17, 18, you could even go to 20, and the food laws, which is Matthew 15 and Mark 7, we already are clearly aware of the NICNT and their position. The Dedicae speaks to that. So I'm going to give you a slight introduction, and then we're going to look at evidence that's going to support the contention. So let's start with just the overview. This is recognized as a manual of instruction for proselytes. Now remember, the proselyte ceremony has been done away with in Yeshuic Judaism. A manual of instruction for proselytes adopted from the synagogue by the sect of the Nazarenes, then transformed over time into a Christian church manual, where it was discovered among a collection of ancient Christian manuscripts in 1873. This Dedicae, this work is mentioned by Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History and in Athanasius' Festal Letters. These are both 4th century. This was something that they knew about, but then it seemed to get lost and didn't show up again until the 9th century. But we're going to move forward. Whenever we talk about these things, we're always looking for the scholarly consensus. The most acceptable theory among many is that which is proposed by Charles Taylor in 1886, and this is right after they found it, and accepted in 1895 by Dr. Harnack. And that is, the first part of the Didache, the teaching concerning the two ways, was originally a manual of instruction used for the initiation of proselytes in the synagogue and was later converted into a Christian manual and ascribed to Yeshua and the apostles. To it were added rules concerning baptism, fasting and prayer, the benedictions over the wine and bread after the communion meal, and regulations regarding the believing community. It addresses the problem, and this is a note because we're going to go into this a little more detail when we go to the document. It addresses the problem of apostles attempting to teach against Torah observance for the Gentile community. Yes, you heard me right, and I know you're shocked and frozen, so I'm going to read it again because it is so shocking. The Didache addresses the problem of apostles attempting to teach against Torah observance for the Gentile community. I know, hard to believe. I gotcha. It also addresses the role of ritual purity in the process of gaining maturity in the faith. These are two subjects that are primary in our study of NICNT, the doing away with the law and doing away with the food laws. To have a document that was written in the late 1st century, early 2nd century, that says that there is a problem with apostles who are attempting to teach against Torah observance for the Gentile community, that's saying something. As part of my overview, I want to just mention what we could call the contents of the Didache. The whole teaching is summarized in the first two verses. There are two ways, one of life and one of death. And wide is the difference between. The way of life is this. First, thou shalt love God thy maker. Second, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now going to Matthew 7, verse 13 and 14, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So this is the overview that I want to present. And so now I'm going to give you the evidence that's going to support our contention about what the Didache is saying. And then once we finish the evidence, which once again, of course, is an overview, then we will get right into the document. As I had mentioned early on in this segment, we already looked at Matthew 23, we looked at Peter in Acts 10, we looked at the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, and we looked at Paul in the last quarter of the book of Acts. These passages have a history of interpretation in which the law has been done away or the food law has been done away. But now I want to bring to your attention some history that goes in the time period after the Didache was authored. As an example, to obey the decree that was the apostolic council's writing in Acts 15, the martyrs of Lyons in the year 177 ate kosher food bought at a Jewish meat market. This comment is written in a book called Dying for God, Martyrdom and the Making of Christianity and Judaism, and the author is Daniel Bayorin, who is one of the leading, if not the leading, Talmudic scholar in the world today. And that was his understanding of this Christian group who was obeying the Jerusalem decree. Next quote. The Christians of Africa in the late 2nd century took seriously the decree. Its requirements were viewed as law in the Church of the East. That's found in the work by Dr. Simon, Verbis Israel, a study of the relations between Christians and Jews in the Roman Empire, AD 135 to 425. According to another scholar, the prescriptions of the apostolic decree enjoyed almost universal assent in the church until at least the 6th century. Pretty long. Moreover, the Levitical 11 dietary laws were observed as late as the 4th century in some Gentile Christian quarters. And then there's a quote, and in the quote it says, "The minds of the ignorant and simple people are anxious about that which enters the mouth and which cannot make a man impure." That's the Yeshua teaching, Mark 7, Matthew 15. "And those who torment themselves about such things speak thus, 'God gave instructions and commandments to his servant Moses concerning clean and unclean foods.'" Interesting quote. That's also in Dr. Simon's book. "They also existed communities of Jewish believers who remained faithful to the Mosaic law." Baghetti notes that in the time of Constantine, the faithful, while they were leaving the church on Easter Day, were forced to eat pork under pain of death. But the sect of the Nazarenes refused this in order not to transgress the Mosaic law to which they held they were bound. There has been extensive research over the period of some 250 years, texts that were written by a dozen authors. And what is amazing is that they all understood that the food laws were not done away with. So based on history, there's no evidence at that point in time in the second century, and some of this is late second century, the Didache would be early second century, if not late first century. They don't know that the food laws have been done away with. With that, let's go ahead and get into the Didache now. I want to start with a book. It's a very small book. It's available online at biblicalarchaeology.org, and it's called The Didache, A Missing Piece of the Puzzle in Early Christianity. And I got a couple of quotes from it. Here's what it says. "It is becoming increasingly apparent that the Didache originated in an early Jewish Christian community with a keen interest in ritual purity and holiness, striving for perfection in Torah observance, but welcoming Gentile converts." Wow. And the second quote from this document, "Not only does it affirm Torah observance, but it also makes no mention of the death and resurrection of Yeshua." That was a big deal in the second century, in the formation of the new Christian church that was going to come into existence fully under Constantine. But it is interesting that we are focusing on behavior and the production of fruit in the life of the believer, and we're not getting waylaid by the distraction of an important point, but the distraction about the death and resurrection. This document was about behavior. Death and resurrection, very important, but this document was about behavior. Next, I want to just read a few lines. We have chapter 1, "There are two ways. One is the way of life, and the other is the way of death. And there's a great difference between the two ways." What did Yeshua say about the road? The road to death is wide, and a lot of people are on it. The road to life is narrow, and very few are on it. And chapter 1, verse 1 of the Didache says, "There are two ways. One is the way of life, and the other is the way of death. And there's a great difference between the two ways." Wow. That pretty much states it, doesn't it? Another way to talk about this, the Didache, would be it's a manual for discipleship. It's about the application in your life and not about theology. these people coming in, it's not based on knowledge acquisition. Like you could go back to Matthew 28, 19 and 20. A lot of English translations say, go and make disciples. Versus, go discipling the nations. Live your life in such a way that they can see it and follow after. As Paul stated to the believers in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, about how they were imitating the believers in Judea. There'll be some points that they need to take hold of, and they're working toward a level of maturity. The next document I want to go to is called Pure Sacrifice in the Dedicae. Now, I'm going to quote a few things from it. The first one is, a re-examination of this text against the background of Jewish biblical exegesis may provide us with a different understanding. It is the product of a community which lived and breathed the world of first century Judaism. Page 3. The governing principle in the instructions on baptism in chapters 7 through 10 is ritual purity. Hey! They're still talking about ritual purity. Yes, that ritual purity that was done away with in Matthew 15 and Mark 7. Here, we're still talking about it as though it hasn't been done away with. That's interesting. And the consequent holiness of the community. Very good. We know the Dedicae breaks down some of the details of that, including baptism. In chapter 7 through 15, there are a lot of things that talk about the purity. And it was talking to the Gentiles in a Gentile community. The next document I want to quote is entitled Torah and Troublesome Apostles in the Dedicae Community. This is from Novum Testamentum, volume 33. In this, the author brings out some incredibly shocking pieces of information. So I'm going to read those quotes so that we can touch on this. There was a problem in the community. And that problem was there were some people who were teachers and they were teaching accurately. They were teaching Torah observance. Then a time came when they taught against Torah observance. Matthew addresses this in chapter 5, the man who teaches one to break Torahs, at least in the kingdom. In the Dedicae, it says, the one who is teaching claims to be an apostle, but must not be received by the community. He is one who has turned. He once was acceptable, but his present teaching makes him unacceptable because it is regarded as threatening the foundational norms of the community. Yes, you heard me correct. Torah observance of the Gentile communities in the second century, the foundational norms of the community was Torah observance. Now, the Torah observance that we're talking about, the document goes on to say, is interpreted through the lens of Yeshua, who came to make the corrections, untangle the oral tradition. We've already addressed that. So the Dedicae suggests that one should receive a teacher who interprets Torah in a way that adds to righteousness, but not one who advocates the abolition of the Torah. Now, Matthew speaks about that in chapter 5, 21 through 47, each one of them heightening, in other words, adding to righteousness. In this document, it talks about, in chapter 6, 2 and 3, about food. And basically, it's saying, take on the yoke of Yeshua. But if you can't, then do the best you can in taking it on. Fully taking it on will take your life to the level of maturity that we are shooting for. Chapter 6, verses 3 clearly refers to the question of idol worship and belongs in the realm of the ritual food laws, the same ones that were done away with in Matthew 15 and Mark 7. And interestingly, the text says the whole yoke of the Lord. The last point I want to make in this discussion has to do with the threat to the community that is mentioned within the Dedicae. And these are the people who were once faithful members. They have turned against the community because they've changed what they're teaching from observance of the instructions of the Most High to getting rid of the instructions of the Most High. They are called wolves come from outside the community clothed as sheep, but that's not the problem. That's Matthew's perspective. But these people were there, and they made a change. And the word that is used is anomia, the same word that's used in Matthew 7 when Yeshua says, "Depart from me." And if you look at the Greek, it's because of anomia. And that is the problem here. We have the same thing taking place in the Dedicae that Yeshua is speaking about in chapter 7. So to wrap this up, if you study the enemies that are addressed in the Dedicae, the community is still living within the boundaries of Torah, though threatened by those former members of the community who, in its view, advocate the abolition of the law. The one who is claiming this abolition of the law claims to be an apostle. He is to be excluded from the community. He is like a sheep who has turned into a wolf and will destroy the community if left inside. So much more needs to be addressed concerning the Dedicae. But I wanted you to see this early teaching and see where it fits in the time, place, end of first century, beginning of second century, to help the Gentiles continue in their observance of Torah. And, oh yeah, by the way, it doesn't appear that the food laws have been done away with, and it doesn't appear that ritual purity and the purity system has been done away with. Actually, it does appear that the ones who are proclaiming that are the enemies of the community. They've turned into wolves, and they're attempting to destroy the community. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.